Morning, brothers and sisters. I'd like to give a quick thanks to anyone and everyone who helped me with this talk. As I'm sure you've heard multiple times this weekend, the word Deuteronomy means second law or repetition of the law. In Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, laws had been publicized at intervals. However, once they entered the land, all the generations who had received the laws will all have died, aside from Caleb and Joshua. Now, in their wanderings, just before entering Canaan, these laws were rehearsed and expounded in anticipation of settled life. Leading up to Deuteronomy 28, there were two sermons given by Moses. In the first, Moses went over a review of Israel's history. In the second, he reviewed the law and the application of the law. In Deuteronomy 27, as recently covered, he has them write down all the laws on stone tablets to set up once they enter the Holy Land. And he continues this lecture, going over the blessings and cursings according to the law. Now on to Deuteronomy 28. I found this chapter very interesting, to say the least, as it goes over the many blessings they will have if they obey these laws, and punishments they will have if they disobey them. This chapter is fairly long, and the first thing that stuck out to me is there are way more curses for disobedience than there are blessings for obedience. This could be for several reasons. According to the King James Version Study Bible, this is probably due to human nature. The threat of a severe judgment on the covenant breaker seems to act as a stronger stimulus to correct behavior than any promise of blessing. Another idea, somewhat related, is that Moses saw day to day how unfaithful the majority of the Israelites were and knew their nature, so he was attempting to instill some fear into the ones who could be influenced. Although the law of Deuteronomy has been fulfilled and we are now under Christ's law, many of the same laws and consequences apply to us. One lesson I found in this chapter, put into words the best way I can imagine by Brother Glenn Rose the other day while we were working together, he said, "There is no better way that I would like to live, even in this life, than the one God has laid out for us, not even considering the divine blessings we will receive in the future if we obey God's commandments. We can see almost every sin people commit in this life usually has natural consequences following not long after. I could name these on forever, but for the sake of time, I'll just list a few. Homosexuality causes higher rates of STD transfers, as well as starting up over half of the newly discovered HIVs. Greed makes humans always want more. They're never happy with what they have. They think, oh, well, if I could just have enough to afford that new boat or a new house or a new car, I'd be happy. So they try and get more and more. The few who have all the money they could want and more are the ones who seem the most depressed with nothing more to live or strive for. Now back to the chapter at hand. This chapter starts off with Moses telling the people the blessings that will come to them if they diligently obey the laws that God had set for them. This continues for the first 14 verses. The next 54 verses of this chapter, until the completion, are the exact opposite, showing the many curses that will befall the people if they would not obey the Lord. Throughout these curses, we can see numbers of important prophecies that we can see being fulfilled throughout history. Not to tread on the feet of the next presenter, but the first verse of the next chapter appears as if it's finishing up this one, reading, "These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb." I won't go into any detail, being as it's part of Brother Peter's speech, but I thought it was an interesting point to add. Returning to the start of the chapter, I'll briefly summarize and expound on a couple of interesting points. The blessings cover everything a God-loving person could want and more. The Israelites would be set above the other nations. They would be healthier. All their crops and animals, even their tools and storage houses, would be blessed and flourish. Their enemies would be smitten and scattered. They would be the Lord's people, and all the nations would know it. This, in itself, would not only put Israel above the other nations, but it would also bring glory and knowledge of the one true God to these other nations, which should bring great joy to any God-loving person. They would be rich in goods and be allowed to stay in the land. Also, the Lord would make them the head rather than the tail. If possible, I'd like to hear some comments on what all this statement could possibly entail or relate to. On the surface, it seems simple, but I feel like it could be expounded into something much deeper. Being as we are looking back on this as history, we know that Israel did not obey the Lord's commandments, at least not for long. Hence, the rest of the chapter can all be seen as history, as prophecies revealed through history. Some of them being very specific. They are one of the most important ways we have to prove the Bible true. This punishment, threatened and eventually carried out, is tremendous. The curse follows these general points. Agricultural, local, and international tragedies, including the reverse of all the blessings they would have received, which includes sickness and destruction while occupying the defeat and destruction while occupying the Holy Land. The removal of the 10 tribes into all the kingdoms of the earth, with all its associated evils and consequences, including many foreign sicknesses, physical impairments, and betrayals among themselves. The Babylonish captivity, in which the king of Judah is involved, is spoken of in verse 36, as a nation that they had not heard of. I'll read verse 36. The Lord shall bring thee, and the king, and thy king, which thou shalt set over thee, unto a nation which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, and there shalt thou serve other gods, wood and stone. At the time Moses spoke of this, Babylon in fact did exist, but it was not yet a nation or a power. Therefore, Israel wouldn't have heard about them or dealt with them before. The Israelites would go into subjection to the Gentiles after the reestablishment from captivity. Their name would become a mockery. Their crops wouldn't be fruitful, and their children would be sold into captivity. Verse 46 states, "And they being the Gentiles, shall be upon thee for a sign and for a wonder, and upon thy seed forever." We know it won't actually be forever, because once Christ returns, his kingdom will conquer the world. In Young's literal translation, it reads, "until the age," which seems more correct to me, and to Dr. Thomas as well, as he states in The Last Days of Judah's Commonwealth on the matter, that their subjection to the Gentiles would continue until the age of the Messiah's administration. Another curse tells of the subjugation to the Greco-Latin horn of the goat, also known as the Roman Empire power. This curse would have started as the Greeks conquered Persia, who were the current world power at that time, and thereby Israel as well. This part of the chapter shows extreme, undeniable detail, starting at verse 49. "The Lord shall bring a nation against thee from afar, from the end of the earth, as swift as an eagle flieth, a nation whose tongue thou shalt not understand." Not only was this correct, since Greece rose to power and conquered Persia and all the known world unexpectedly and at an incredibly fast rate, but also because the symbol of the Greeks was the eagle of Zeus, and the Romans, who became the world power a short time after the Greeks did, had an eagle on their standards representing their legions. Also, both of these languages spoke a different language than Israel. This curse continues on. Jerusalem would be sieged, stripped of its possessions, and destroyed. They would become desperate. They would become so desperate as to eat their own children. Even the kindest of them would turn evil against their former loved ones. Their population would be reduced drastically, and they would be scattered among all the nations. This cursed prophecy we can see even unto this day. Israel wasn't even a nation until recently, and the Jews are still spread around the world, though they're making their way back now as the age of Messiah approaches, seen by us as another sign of the times. They would be slaves in faraway lands and find no rest among these nations, only distress. I found another point interesting. When it talks about one nation fleeing from another in this chapter, it says they would be spread seven ways, such as in verse 7, "The Lord shall cause thine enemies to rise up against thee and to be smitten before thy face. They shall come out against thee one way and flee before thee seven ways." Also in verse 25, "The Lord shall cause thee to be smitten before thine enemies. Thou shalt go out one way against them, and flee seven ways before them, and shall be removed into all the kingdoms of the earth." Seven in the Bible represents complete. So it could be seen that it would be a complete dispersion of the people, which is what we saw in Israel's case. The biggest lesson we can take out of this chapter, if it isn't obvious enough, can be seen clearly by looking at the reasons given throughout the chapter for why these curses would and did happen to Israel. In verse 15, "But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments and his statutes which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee." In verse 58, "If thou wilt not observe to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that thou mayest fear the glorious and fearful name of the Lord thy God." And in verse 62, "And ye shall be left few in number, whereas ye were as the stars of heaven for multitude, because thou wouldest not obey the voice of the Lord thy God." Thanks for all your attention, and I'll look forward to y'all's comments.
Thank you, Brother Aaron. And we now open the floor up to discussions, questions, comments. I could also use some help with the that virus with the tail and the head, Brother Johnny.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Our brother's given us a great synopsis of this chapter, and he mentioned a great point that there's much more said about the curses than the blessings. And we might think, well, why is that? But we think about it, it's like we've been saying this weekend, that the truth in itself is basically simple. It's when you stray from the truth that it gets complicated and therefore has to have solutions to repair it that are much more detailed than the simplicity that's in the truth. And try to make an attempt and an example of what he mentioned, where God says, you know, be the head and the tail, the head and not the tail. When we, obviously, it's a simple idea that, you know, you're on top, you're not on the bottom, you're not at the end. But if we turn to Zechariah chapter 8, it gives us an example of that, of Israel. And as he said, we know they didn't keep it, and they ended up with all these curses. But Zechariah gives the nation great hope and tells them, verse 11, when we look at the return of Christ, the regathering of the people, and the establishing of the kingdom, it says, but now I will not be unto the residue of this people as in the former days, because the former days where they ended up cursed, saith the Lord. Verse 13, and it shall come to pass that as ye were a curse among the heathen, now it's past tense, O house of Judah and Israel, so will I save you, and ye shall be a blessing. Then the blessings will come in the kingdom age. Fear not, let your hands be strong. And then we go down to the 20th verse, and we get the idea of what would that mean to be the head and not the tail. And the 20th verse on says, thus saith the Lord of hosts, it shall come to pass that there shall come people, and the inhabitants of many cities, the inhabitants of one city shall go to another, saying, let us go speedily to pray before the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will go also, yea, many people and strong nations. The nations, when they are conquered and when they capitulate, shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem to pray before the Lord. And goes on to say that 10 men out of all nations shall take hold of the skirt that him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. So it's a beautiful type of the fulfillment in the kingdom age when the nations see the blessings in Israel and they say, we want that.
Brother Philip Hughes.
Yeah, I'd like to add my thanks to Brother Aaron. I thought he'd, as Brother Johnny said, give a great synopsis of the chapter, loads of verses in it, and Brother Aaron give us a real good taster for the whole of the chapter, especially drawing our attention to the number of curses in ratio to the number of blessings, and that I really appreciated the suggestions he made on that. I'd like to make a comment upon the verse which we find, the first verse, it shall come to pass if thou shalt hearken diligently. I don't know whether we've noticed, but the word here comes up quite a number of times in the book of Deuteronomy. We've seen it, if we look carefully, in the chapters we've already been considering this week. And I think the Jews, in reference to Deuteronomy 6, Hear, O Israel, I think they call it the Shema. I might be wrong there, but it's from a Hebrew word meaning to hear intelligently. Now, I never met Brother Bill Sharp, but I heard an exhortation that he gave on hearing, and it stuck in my mind because he said, we listen, but sometimes we don't hear. I can't remember his words exactly, but we were all hearing Aaron's voice this morning. You're hearing my voice now. But do we listen? And I think Brother Bill sort of referred to the inner ear. And in, I think it's the fifth chapter that we were considering yesterday, the day before, Moses says, hear, O Israel, the statutes and the judgments which I speak in your ears. Hear them. Now, some of us are parents here, and I guess we've often had the opportunity, and mums are really good at this. We tend to give children a telling off if they've done something wrong, and the child is sitting there on a chair or something, or standing in the corner, and we're sort of like berating them with what they've done wrong, and we tend to see their eyes glazing over a little bit as we're sort of like rehearsing all the things that they shouldn't have done. And, you know, the statement comes out, "Are you listening to me?" And I think this is the, well, of course, they hear the words resonating in their eardrums, and, you know, the sounds are bouncing off the walls when you're giving them a telling off. But the parent recognizes that they may not be listening with the inner ear. And I think this is what basically Moses and Yahweh through Moses was trying to get over to the children of Israel. Are you listening to me? And in the chapter that Brother Aaron has drawn attention, this is really powerfully brought out. If thou wilt hearken, it's the same word, if you will listen intelligently, if you will really bend your ears, as it were, to listen and to understand what I'm telling you. Because like a good parent, a parent doesn't really want to give its child a row. It doesn't want to be give it a telling off at all. It wants to, you know, bathe it with love and concern. But a good parent will also realize that there is a time where they really have to enforce a law and to remind the child what's good for it. And, you know, in the days when Israel were in captivity in Babylon, Yahweh says to Ezekiel, because it seems as if Ezekiel was thinking he's getting somewhere with the people, he says, "Oh yeah, the people are coming to listen to you now, Ezekiel. They're coming to hear your words, but your words are unto them as a lovely song, for they hear thy words, but they do them not." So the people were gathering around Ezekiel. They were enjoying the sermon he was giving them, but they weren't listening intelligently. They weren't letting it enter into their minds, into the inner ear. It was like a lovely song. And we can all be like that. We can sit down in the meetings and, you know, we're really enjoying it. But are we listening? Are we going to take with us the words that Brother Aaron has warned us about today? And he's applied some of those lessons to ourselves. So I think sometimes we can be dull of hearing. And I think Brother Aaron, in the remarks that he's pointed forward, has pointed out to us the issues of life and death in this chapter.
Brother Dave Somerville.
just to go along with the question that was asked with the head and the tail. If you look in Strong's, it talks about the head as like the pinnacle of a mountain. You know, you think of the view that you have from there, or the strength of an army. You're the king of the mountain. There's great strength in there. And the tail, it talks about the like a cut-off stump. You know, the tree might have been magnificent, might have produced fruit, might have been valuable, but once it's cut down and there's only a stump, there's nothing left with it. So I think that's the... you know, it kind of goes along with what Brother Johnny said as well. and to make a comment on this chapter, I wish that this is the way God judged us. And it might sound funny that I say that, but when things go well, it doesn't mean that we're doing living the most spiritual way in our life. And when things don't go so well, that doesn't mean that we're not doing the right thing. And that's something that I've been, you know, kind of struggling with and going through. It's you read through this in the blessing and the cursing, but that's the blessing and the cursings to a nation. It's not to each individual. Throughout the good years, there was, I'm sure, times when one guy's field was not as prosperous as his neighbor. And you know, he might look at him and say, "Well, you know, why am I not being blessed?" and stuff like that. So, you know, we know the story of Job. We know that bad things don't happen to bad people. But then when we read through chapters like this, that sometimes kind of builds that humanistic way of thinking in our minds and say, "Oh, yeah, if things are going good, I must be living the life that I'm supposed to be living." And, you know, it's a balance that we have to constantly examine ourselves to make sure that what we're doing, if it's not being blessed, are we going the right way? And if we are, then we have to overcome the trials that are being put there. And if things are going too smoothly, maybe we need to evaluate the direction we're going, because maybe we're getting off track, and that's why things are going so well. We heard the exhortation yesterday about being friends with the world. You know, if we have friends with the world, and sometimes we might be able to feel good about our life and things are going smooth, but that might only be for a short amount of time. So we, you know, that's the importance of having gatherings, going to meetings, midweek Bible classes, to constantly be examining ourselves, because the blessings and the cursings are not immediate.
Okay, I got Brother Bob Larquette, Dave Van Pelt, and Aaron Meyer. Okay, Brother Van Pelt.
Brethren and sisters, Deuteronomy is the reiteration or the second presentation of the law. It stands as a witness of the vicissitudes of Israel, the things that would befall them if they were faithful and did the things of the law that were required of them. They would become the head of the nations. We realize in the age to come they shall be the head. The first dominion is come unto the daughter of Zion. Israel shall be that first dominion. But the first thing we wanted to bring out is that Moses, in presenting these things, was showing and forecasting the future of the nation. When they came into the land, God gave them good. He prospered them marvelously. He did all that he had spoken that he would do for them. But they corrupted themselves, as Moses had shown. They corrupted themselves with idols and learning the ways of the nations they were supposed to have destroyed, driven out. They learned their ways. And it's a lesson to us. And then the curses, of course, came upon them. All these things bear witness to the fact that God has been, is, and shall be working with the Jews to bring to pass the fact that they will be that royal nation, that royal priesthood, that holy nation, that peculiar people. And so the world and the cavilers and the scorners, they're all turned on their heads. It's marvelous when you see how accurately all these things have come to pass exactly as Yahweh had shown Moses they would, and as he showed the nation of Israel. We look forward now to the day of their restoration. They are the tail. They are the least of the nations. In the last 70 years, there were 6 million of them killed. It's a refining process. Though Israel shall be as the sand of the sea and as the stars of heaven for multitude, we see that it will be a remnant that is saved. A remnant compared to the multitude that is present at the time of Christ's return, scattered among the nations, ready to be roused up as a lion. We wait and hope for that day, and look for the day when they shall be given, as is shown in chapter 30, praise and fame among all the nations where they formerly had been persecuted and put to shame, where they were required to prostrate their bodies even with the ground that the goyim, the unclean, could pass over. The day will come when God will exalt them, when 10 men shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, when the aliens shall be their plowmen and build up their walls. But those days are still a ways off. They've got to be made to understand, even among the heathen, that they have sinned, that they have transgressed, that all these things have come upon them, as per Deuteronomy 28, 29, and 30. These are wonderful chapters, though the curses are so horrific and terrible, but they're a strict and severe warning to each and every one of us. We need to take heed to these words. Though we're not under the law, there awaits for those who transgress and will not repent a dire and a terrible judgment, the second death that awaits after the judgment on the household of God.
So there is a baser meaning for head and tail. So if you think of a head consumes, it gets the pleasantness of the food, it tastes. Mm-hmm. And then what does the tail end get, right? Don't want to be too crude. But in Isaiah it says, the ancient and honorable, he is the head, and the prophet that teacheth lies, he is the tail. You know, so you can think what's coming out of the mouth of the prophet that teacheth lies being the tail. So when you look in Deuteronomy 28, when he says, he shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him, he consumes from you, some interest on it. So he accumulates from you and consumes from you, and you get wasted for it. So.
Thank you. Brother Ben and then Brother Glendon, that might be all the time we have.
I'd just like to add my thanks to Brother Aaron and just bring out or add to one of his comments he already made. In his opening remarks, he referenced in verse, I believe it was 46, where we read that they shall be upon thee for a sign and for a wonder and upon thy seed forever. And Brother Aaron mentioned and referenced Brother Thomas in his and also the literal translation, how he said that that forever doesn't actually mean forever, but it means to the age, I believe is what he said. And he referenced Brother Thomas. And Brother Thomas in Eureka does an excellent job of explaining what this means, and it's just one more way that we can have a better understanding of some of the words used in Scripture, as we've already talked several times about how we read it in English, but it was written in Hebrew or Greek, and so we lose some of the meaning. And so, as Brother Aaron said, that this forever, well, this here, of course, is olam in the Greek, in the Hebrew. That's how we see forever in many places, and it doesn't always mean the idea that we think of as forever. You know, if we say the words forever, we think it's just going to, you know, continue going on and on and on. Well, if we look at some of the other places it's used in the Old Testament, for example, in Genesis chapter 9, we read about the rainbow. The bow shall be in the cloud. I will look upon it that I may remember the everlasting covenant. The everlasting covenant, or the Olam covenant. It's a covenant that was for a hidden period. It was for a period of time. Again, in Genesis chapter 17, I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee in generations for an everlasting covenant, or an Olam covenant. I will give unto thee and to thy seed the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, an Olam possession, as it says there in the Hebrew. And you think, well, that's kind of funny, because for thousands of years, or hundreds of years, the seed of Abraham did not have the possession of the land. But we know that it is a future age, a future period, that they will receive the promise of that land. But even more interesting is the use of the word in the Greek. The word is aeon, and we see in Revelation chapter 14 the same idea, forever, everlasting. We read in Revelation 14, verse 6, I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel. Well, that word everlasting is aeon. It would be better if we would read that verse that we saw this angel flying in mid-heaven, having aeonian news. He has news. It's not this idea of just everlasting. It's this idea of aeonian news, this period that's about to be ushered in of the kingdom age. And so it's just very interesting, and I was very glad that Aaron brought that up, you know, that that's not just the words forever like we think of it in the English, but that there is some other meaning to it also.
Thank you. Brother Glendon?
I wanted to make an additional comment on this, the ratio of curses to blessings. If we go back to the first time that Moses spoke to Israel, and I shouldn't say the first time, but after he was at the burning bush, and he goes to Israel, and God tells him, "You tell Israel, I have heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant." And as you read through here, try to think about how much of this is blessing and how much of it is a curse. "I have remembered my covenant, wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgments," all blessing. "And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burden of the Egyptians," all blessing. "And I will bring you in unto the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob, and I will give it you for inheritance. I am the Lord." All blessing again, right? And he expected this promise of blessing to motivate the children of Israel to obey him, to follow him. And then when you get to the spies, the report of the spies, and they go through the land and they say, "Surely the land flows with milk and honey. And this is the fruit of it." They're bearing it between two men on a pole. This is the fruit of it. Again, the blessing of the land. They had this promise of blessing, and yet it didn't motivate them to righteousness. You know, God said, "Here's the blessing. Walk in the way and you'll receive it," and it didn't motivate them. And so now, at the end of all this time that Moses has put up with them, 40 years of disobedience, of saying, "I don't think the blessings are worth it. Oh, let's go back to Egypt. It was fine there." Almost zero motivation by these blessings. Now, what's the ratio? He's giving them negative reinforcement. He's saying, "If you don't obey me, these are the bad things that will happen." And he takes them back, actually, to the ideas of Egypt. You know, he talks about the botch of Egypt. "I will smite thee with the botch of Egypt, and with the emrods, and with the scab, and with the itch, whereof thou canst not be healed. I will smite thee with madness, and blindness, and astonishment at heart. Thou shalt grope at noonday, as the blind gropeth in darkness, and not prosper in thy ways." Okay, so he's taking them back and saying, "You remember how bad it was in Egypt, the worst of that? I'm going to take you back to that if you won't obey." And I really think the Jews have kind of given us a modern-day example of that. We go to Jeremiah 16, verse 16. They're still the same people because they can't be very well motivated by good things, by blessings. They're better motivated by curses. He says in Jeremiah 16, 16, this is speaking of the latter days, "Behold, I will send for many fishers, saith the Lord," and this is speaking of fishing with a bait on a hook, "and they shall fish them. And after will I send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks." And I wish I could remember the stats, but you know, in 1917, the Balfour Declaration came out, and basically the Jews were invited to return to the land of Israel and make a nation for themselves, or at least a homeland for themselves. And the response was pretty small. I mean, it's a very small proportion of the world's Jews that came back. Then in the Holocaust, they were hunted out of every hill and mountain and hole and rock, and they swarmed into Israel. That negative motivation was so much stronger than positive. But we have a choice. Will we be motivated by positive things or by negative things? Hopefully, we can be among the few like Joshua and Caleb that were motivated by positive things. They said, the blessings of the land are enough to make me want to go in. And we look forward to that kingdom and say, yeah, I want that, and that will motivate me. But if not, if God's merciful enough at least, He'll bring cursings on us and hopefully give us that negative reinforcement.
Thank you. I think that's a great place to end right there.